Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Project Zion podcast. I'm Josh, I'll be your host for this episode. With us today, we have somebody that's well-known and well-beloved on both sides of the Mississippi. With us today is Steve Shields. We're going to be talking today about his upbringing. For many that do know him, know that he grew up LDS, switched over to the RLDS church in a different era than what a lot of seekers would be finding themselves in their situation now, looking into Community of Christ. So, Steve, how about you give us an introduction about yourself, and we'll start from just your early childhood on up.
Okay, great. Well, hi, everybody. I'm glad to be able to share a little bit today. I was born and raised in Utah, born in Logan, raised in Tooele County, and went to BYU for a year, went on an LDS mission to South Korea, and about 36 years ago, I was met with a faith crisis and changed my faith trajectory and became what was then the RLDS Church. My families, both on my mother's and father's sides, have been in the Latter-day Saint movement since the time of the original church. Great-great-grandfather on my mother's side, that family came to what was then the colonies in Massachusetts in the 1600s, and eventually great-great-grandfather found the LDS Church then and joined that. Actually, it was the Church of the Latter-day Saints when he joined. It hadn't become the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for another year.
So 1837?
37.
Yeah. What was his name, do you know?
His name's Albert Perry Rockwood, and he was in the Vanguard Company of Pioneers that entered the Salt Lake Valley on July 24th, 1847. I have that, you know, pioneer heritage in Utah. My father's side of the family were Scottish, and they joined the original church about 1840, and 10 years later made their way to Utah and went out to the Tooele Valley to be part of the settlement out there. So I've got a rich Utah heritage, and I'm proud of my Utah heritage.
So you said you grew up in Tooele. That's about where I grew up as well. What took your family out there?
Well, my dad was born and raised in Pine Canyon, which is just northeast of Tooele City. And our family had been out in Pine Canyon since about 1851. And that was just home, even though my mother was a Salt Lake City girl. Mom and Dad met up at Utah State, and
oh, yeah, just like Brittany and I, it seems
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Utah State. I guess people from Tooele County have been going up there for a long time then.
Well, when my dad went there, it was called Utah State Agricultural College. And because, you know, the family had a lot of farming that they were doing, it just seemed natural that Dad would pursue something related. And in fact, his bachelor's degree was in animal husbandry. And he turned that into a science degree and worked for the federal government for a few years at Dugway Proving Grounds. And when Mom got pregnant with me, Dad decided that maybe working on germ warfare wasn't the best thing to do. And so they went back up to Logan for a year so Dad could get his teaching certificate. And he started teaching school in Grantsville, Utah, and stayed as an educator in the Tooele County School District until he retired in his 60s. So that's, you know, Tooele County's home territory for me. Spent 6 or 7 years living in Wendover when Dad was principal of the schools out there. And then in the southeast corner of Tooele up on the slopes of the mountain until I was 18 and went to BYU, I guess, is sort of when I left town.
So he worked for Grantsville High School?
He taught at Grantsville High School for a few years, and then the district sent him off to be a principal. In Wendover, and then he came back to Tooele and was principal at two different elementary schools in Tooele.
Yeah, okay. I bet Grantsville was even smaller back then.
Oh, certainly was, yeah.
That whole area has seen a lot of growth. Yeah.
Well, interestingly enough, he started his teaching career at Grantsville, did principal work for several years, and then he ended up as a science teacher back at Grantsville High, and then moved to Tooele Junior High and finished his career teaching science there. So he'd pretty much been around the whole district.
So do you have any fond memories growing up LDS in that time frame?
Well, I mean, everybody in the neighborhood was LDS, and the odd family or that was not were rare. But, you know, our neighborhood was a pretty close-knit neighborhood. And, of course, I was going to school with all the kids and going to church with the families. And we did Boy Scouts together. And Mom was in the Relief Society presidency one way or another for much of my growing up years, and until they couldn't do bazaars anymore to do fundraising, we were always doing bazaars. And
what's bazaars?
A bazaar. Oh, back in the old days, the Relief Society would do all sorts of handicraft things and then once a year have a big sale. There'd be baked goods, and my grandmother did tatting, which is a lace making sort of a craft, and there'd be embroidered pillowcases and quilts and just all kinds of pretty much practical household types of items that the Relief Society would put on sale once a year, and the money would support the ward budget.
Oh, okay.
But that was all. That all stopped, I think, in the
1980s.
Well, it might have been earlier than the 80s. I'm not sure, but anyway, there was a little bit of a conflict, you know, doing those kinds of things not charging sales tax and doing it on the, you know, on a non-taxable nonprofit facility, and it would have gotten pretty complicated for those things to continue. And I think church headquarters put a stop to them just because of those potential conflicts on taxation. But I don't know the real history of that. Somebody else can look that up.
Right.
So, you know, there was never a question growing up that, you know, when I turned 19, I'd go on a mission, and, you know, BYU was always the future, you know, college place, you know, for me to go. And Dad never pushed about going to Utah State, even though he was a true blue Aggie fan till the day he died.
Right. So my dad went to BYU, and he had no problem with me going to Utah State. He had always had fond memories of it because his oldest brother that he looked up to, Kenneth, went up to Utah State as well. So when I went up there, he's like, well, I never went here, but it's just as good.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, you turn 18 out of high school, you go to BYU for a year. What was that like?
Oh, it was great. It was exciting. I enjoy studying and reading. So met a lot of new friends in the dormitory. In fact, one of those friends that I met during my freshman year, he and I are still best friends after all these years. He's from California and lives in California still, but, one of those kinds of friends where if you haven't seen each other, even for two or three or four more years, when you get back together, you just kind of pick up where you left off as if you hadn't, you know, maybe seen each other for a month.
Those are the best friendships to have.
They're great. He's a wonderful friend. LDS, you know, fellow.
Right.
But he's, you know, very open-minded and has supported my faith journey as much as I've supported his. So
that's good. So did you have any direction school-wise where you were going at that point? Or were you like most 18-year-olds, you're just doing gen ed and waiting for your mission?
No, I actually was interested in archaeology and anthropology.
Okay.
I hadn't declared a major in that area yet, but I found that very interesting. I've always loved history, and the summer after my freshman year, I went to Nauvoo and spent the summer with a BYU archaeology team there. Historical archaeology is different from non-historical stuff. With historical archaeology, you know that there's either still a building there from the period you're looking at, or that you know where the building was. And so in the case of Nauvoo, the archaeology was to find architectural features or other information that would help them restore those buildings, you know, for the tourist purposes there.
Okay.
Prehistoric archaeology is when you go to some place and you discover all kinds of exciting things.
Whatever your imagination can conjure up.
Right. Much. So one of the sites we dug that summer was what they now call the Cultural Hall, but it really is the Masonic Temple in Nauvoo.
Yeah.
And really what we were doing was digging down around the foundations to see if there was any other, you know, like an extension or whatever else that we could discover, blocked up, entrances. The building had been modified in the years after the Mormon era to become a house, and they'd knocked off the third story, which was the Masonic Temple lodge room, and blocked up a basement entrance that had been used with a staircase down. They'd used the basement as a schoolhouse. So, you know, we knew that stuff was there from historical records. We just had to discover it and record it so that we were doing our due diligence on the site before they did their restoration work.
Okay. Yeah, I think I heard stories about the Masonic Lodge that they had found at least the original flooring.
Yeah, the flooring of the third floor became the floor of the attic when they modified it as a house. So that and I wouldn't be surprised if all the wood flooring on all three stories is the original or was. Now they may have replaced it in the restoration work to
make that's it. Interesting though.
But yeah, the building's an interesting, you know, from a historical and architectural point of view. Had an elevator that went from the back entrance, which was the entrance used by the Masonic Lodge meeting people, and would take them directly up to the lodge room.
How does an elevator work back then? Is it kind of just like a pulley
system? With counterweights, yeah. Counterweights and pulleys, yeah. Yep. So it's an interesting building, and we put a lot of sweat into digging out those the whole foundation.
So that was while you're at your first year at BYU?
That was after the summer after my first year at BYU.
Okay.
And then that fall, I went on my mission.
So going on a mission for you just wasn't in question?
It was never a question. No, there was just never a question about that. And I looked forward to it and I was, you know, excited about going and doing what all good LDS boys and a few girls then were supposed to do. And the mission was a good experience.
Yeah. So what was it like opening up your call and figuring out where you're going and the anticipation for that?
That was pretty exciting. It could have been any place. And Korea was certainly one of the more exotic places that one could go on a mission back in the 70s.
Right. So was that on your radar at all?
Wasn't on my radar at all. No, not at all. When I was in high school, my English teacher just really tried to broaden our horizons. And so he thought in those days they had such a thing called pen pals. You'd actually handwrite letters to people.
Yeah.
Seems kind of odd now, but
I remember my sister doing it. I never got into it too much.
Yeah. Well, he thought it would be a good idea for us. And so he arranged. There was probably some place where you could go and find pen pals. I ended up with a high school girl that was about my same age. She was Korean. And so it gave her an opportunity to practice her English and do a little cultural learning and whatever. So, you know, I'd done that for 2 or 3 years before the mission call and was just really kind of blown away when I was called to Korea, having had that limited contact with a person. And when I got to Korea, I did look her up and, you know, had enjoyed seeing each other in person. And
oh, so you did get to see her?
Yeah. 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 So one of the real blessings that I had In those days, there were very, very few native Korean missionaries. Not only could families not afford it, I mean, in 1975, Korea was still really underdeveloped. Poverty was the norm, and LDS Korean church members were not typically wealthy people. There were some that had resources. Good brother who was in the stake presidency in Seoul when I was a missionary there was a dentist. Another brother was he the other counselor in the stake presidency maybe, was a medical doctor. So there were, you know, some members like that, but by and large, people didn't have a lot of extra money. And so having a native Korean missionary was unusual. Korean boys in those days had to do 3 years of mandatory military service after high school. And so that often delayed any college opportunities. But I had a companion for about 8 months who was a Korean. And
was he older?
He was older, yeah. I was 19, 20. I was 20, I guess, at the time. And he was probably 5 years older than me. Or more, because he'd gone to college. So he might have been as old as 28.
Interesting.
So, yeah. But he spoke English quite well, but was very patient with me. And part of his assignment was to make sure that I could learn to speak Korean well. And we'd go through the day, and only if my life was threatened would he ever speak in English. He pushed the language really hard, and I give him a lot of the credit for my ability to speak the language. He was really patient. Must have driven him nuts when I didn't get stuff.
Yeah.
But and even after my mission, we stayed friends for some time. I've since lost track of him, but really grateful to him for that hard work that he did, because I've used the Korean language ever since. In my subsequent church work.
So you said you went through a faith crisis. Did that start during your mission, or when was that?
Actually, I think my faith crisis probably started in high school.
Okay.
We'd gone on a family trip back east in the country, went to Kirtland Temple, and that was probably the first time I'd really ever consciously heard of the Reorganized Church. And they had all these tracts and things, and being a teenager, you know, and being interested in church history, I was an early boarding seminary student, even when I could have taken release time. I wanted to not miss out on anything, so I had the extra hours worth of school in the morning at seminary.
Yeah.
And I picked up these tracts and was really offended that this other church was claiming the same stories that we were claiming. And
so you were reading their literature?
Yeah, I was reading their tracts. And it's like, wait a minute, how can they claim this? This is our story.
Yeah.
Joseph Smith's vision and...
It definitely would be
all of that.
Weird, yeah.
And we came home from the trip, and somehow or another those little package of tracts ended up in my closet, you know, and never thought about it for a couple of years. I'm in seminary, and the early morning seminary students, our seminary teachers considered us to be exceptional students, and so they made us do more work than the release time seminary students during the day. We had to do term papers, you know, so by the time I hit my senior year, I'd done 12 term papers.
Yeah, that's a lot different than my seminary experience.
And so it's the church history year that I was in my senior year, and like, oh my goodness, what am I going to do a term paper on? I was just out of ideas. And cleaning out my closet one day, came across these RLDS tracts. So I thought, I'll write a paper and show how false the RLDS church is. And it was a big hit with the seminary teachers. One of the principal even had it typed on Ditto Masters and duplicated for the other teachers to have as a resource.
Jeez.
crazy. In those days, the Salt Lake City RLDS folks would have a booth at the state fair, And I'd gone, maybe it was probably the fall fall of my junior year in high school, maybe. I can't remember exactly, but boy, there was one guy there that was so obnoxious. Just, let me show you from the Bible why the Mormon church is wrong, kind of stuff. And I found then, and I still find that approach to be counterproductive and unnecessary. But, you know, if a person says, you know, my faith journey is taking me a different direction, then, you know, my view is, well, you know, we're going to miss you, but, you know, God bless you on your journey, and let's stay friends if we can.
Yeah, it's not the end of the world when you don't claim that your church is the one true church if somebody goes a different direction.
Right. You know, I started to develop those liberal tendencies in high school, I think. Well, I gave my presentation to
being
the class.
Being in Tooele, because that did not happen for me. That was
in Tooele?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was
super conservative.
I was really an anomaly there.
Yeah.
but you know, my mother especially, and I know Dad supported it, worked hard to expose us kids. I have three siblings. To as much experience of the other outside world as the family could afford, which didn't include any overseas travel, but there were a couple of times where we took our travel trailer and hooked it up to the car, and Dad usually had to work as a principal. They don't, you know, principals have 11 month contracts, and so they don't have a lot of time in the summer that they can.
And teachers do.
And then teachers, you know, they get paid a 9 month salary. They don't get paid a 12 month salary. You know, those 3 months in the summer are not vacation time.
Right.
So many have other jobs.
They
spread out their checks. And so even on Dad's month off, it was really important for him to do some kind of extra work. He did landscaping in the summers to kind of make ends meet for the family. But Mother would take us off. Sometimes my mom's dad would go with us, and we traipsed all over the United States. And by the time I graduated from high school, I'd been in probably 45 of the 50 states. And in those days, you know, national monuments and state parks were either free or really modestly priced places to go. We camped in the trailer, and still expensive for the family to do it, but good experiences. So anyway, the paper on the RLDS Church, we had to present our papers to the class, and another kid says, well, I've been out in Independence, and there's another church there that claims to be founded by Joseph Smith. And so, I thought, oh, there's my next term paper. I'll find out about this church.
Yeah. Yeah, they're a dime a dozen. Yeah, on every corner, all four corners, another one true
<That's>
church.
<right. laughs> So this is the Church of Christ on the Temple lot. And so that was my next term paper. And anyway, that I kind of pursued that, and this is tangential to this particular discussion, but eventually it became what has become my life's work in exploring and trying to catalog all of those expressions of the movement.
Right. We'll get on to your book. And
so that's but that started in high school.
Okay. Yeah.
Continued at BYU. And so when I went on my mission and I discovered that the RLDS Church was in Seoul, I tracked them down and wanted a copy of their Korean editions of the scriptures, and met their mission president, who later became an apostle in the RLDS Church and subsequently became a good friend of mine. But
what was his name?
Philip Caswell was his name, and he and his wife and family had been assigned to Korea in the late 60s, early 70s. I can't remember exactly their dates, but when I met them in 76, they'd been there for a few years, and their two boys, who were probably eight and nine at the time, were completely fluent in Korean. It was just the most amazing thing. But it was kind of a passing fancy at the time. There was
just more of an interest.
An interest, a curiosity maybe. I got back from my mission. Then I decided to go back to Korea to teach English and work professionally. And we didn't have lots of money. I couldn't afford to go back to school right at that point. And
when you came back?
After my mission, yeah. So I went back to Korea. I ended up working. I was a copy editor at one of the English language daily newspapers, teaching English also, and worked for several months for the Korean government's economic planning board as an editor. Did that kind of work. So after that was done and I came back to the States, I attended church regularly and got involved in things as much as I could, was working in the publishing industry in Bountiful. And in March of 81, there was a big announcement about this Joseph Smith III blessing document being discovered.
Right. So the whole era of Mark Hoffman presenting documents.
Yep, the Mark Hoffman time. Now, at the time, the document had been analyzed and was deemed to be authentic. And there was, from my perspective, it seemed like a real PR scramble in Salt Lake City to discount, you know, anything about the document and to support Brigham Young's taking over the leadership of at least that part of the church that followed him west. I was kind of surprised by that. Because if, as was believed, this was an authentic document, there certainly should have been a reevaluation of a lot of things instead of just blowing it off.
Yeah, it seemed like the leadership of the LDS Church was paying big money to buy the documents off of Mark just to hide them away.
Well, they were rather embarrassing to the company line.
Right, and I think that's why he was forging them.
Yeah,
because he
had a good customer.
Yeah, and he lost his own faith, so he was making money off of something like that.
Well, you know, a lot of that stuff affected the RLDS Church, too, because as far as the historical stories were concerned, there wasn't a lot of difference. You know, you start putting holes in Joseph Smith's story, you have to reevaluate the whole foundation of the movement, not just the one denomination in it. Now, the RLDS folks overreacted and went against the advice of their first presidency and added that blessing document to the Doctrine and Covenants. And subsequently, it had to be taken out. But the presidency advised against it. But in the RLDS tradition, the World Conference is a legislative assembly. And again, that's another story about how all of those
it's just a different
things work. It's a different culture of how you approach things like that and how decisions are made and so on.
A lot more common consent.
Yeah.
Bottom up.
But I, you know, that caused me to take a look after I was in the tabernacle in Salt Lake City. In those days, the basement of the tabernacle had the translation booths, and we had closed circuit TVs to see what was going on upstairs. And I was in the tabernacle translating for the Koreans during that World Conference in the spring of 81.
Was this the LDS General Conference?
The LDS
Conference?
General Conference. Excuse me. Yes, the LDS General Conference. Yep. Thank you. And Gordon B. Hinckley, who was then an apostle, he gave a 20-minute lecture on the blessing document and figuratively basically ripped it up into little bits and pieces of paper dust and blew it away. And I sat in the basement of the tabernacle during his speech with my jaw dropped. It's like, oh my goodness, you know, if, as we thought, this was an authentic document, you can't just blow it away and call it nothing more than a father's blessing, has no meaning to the church leadership or the succession in the presidency. And he went, I can't quote him exactly now, it's been far too long, but that was the gist of his comment. And I thought to myself, I thought, I don't know any LDS person that wouldn't kill to have a father's blessing from the prophet of the church.
No kidding.
You know, that, you know, if my dad had given me a blessing, okay, right. But if your dad was the prophet, president of the church, and gave you a blessing, especially one that said you are to be my successor in the presidency, a little more than just a plain old father's blessing, it seemed to me. But anyway, you know, it just caused me to say, you know, I felt like the church was trying to hide something. And so I dug out and started rereading church history and started rereading my small collection of RLDS books and discovered that my own theological thinking was really quite in line with the RLDS Church, and that was disturbing because the RLDS Church was, well, you know, I'd grown up as this, you know, Emma Smith's church, this apostate group in the Midwest. There was not a lot of glitz and fanfare around the church. The buildings that I'd visited were, what's the word to use? With only a few exceptions, perhaps ramshackle compared with LDS chapels.
Yeah, not the same money between the two.
And then I'd had, you know, I'd had experience with some of the RLDS folks at their fair booth and found them to be just cold and obnoxious. And it's like, this is really crazy. But I needed to get it out of my system. That same period of time, my marriage was starting to fall apart. And so I was, frankly, I was a seeker. On all kinds of levels. What's happening with my marriage? You know, that's, you know, a lot of personal things there.
So I don't know if you know James Fowler's stages of faith theory.
Sure.
But it sounds like at this time in your life, you're, for multiple reasons, starting to self-examine. Like,
yes.
You know, you're going through life with the unexamined life.
And that's right.
Taking a pause and just examining everything.
Exactly. And I thought, you know, this RLDS church, I'd been to the church in Salt Lake once. I'd visited when I was at BYU, and it was not a really positive experience. But I'd looked at their books and looked at the beliefs and the theology, and it's like, this is more in line with where I'm at, but it makes no sense. And on a Sunday in July, I my wife had left. I was raising my son by myself. He'd gone out to my folks' place to spend the weekend. My mother kind of stepped in and really took up the slack with the lack of a mother in the house. And she was a great blessing in that regard in many, many ways besides that. But
sounds like it would have been a really hard time.
Yeah. So my son was out there, and I thought, well, okay, this, I'm going to go down to the church in Salt Lake and just get this out of my system. And so I was living in Bountiful. The church is in Holiday, just below Mount Olympus there in Salt Lake City.
Same building that they're using now?
Same building as now, yeah. That building was built, I think they moved into it about 64 or 65 and have been in it since. So I got on the freeway, headed south on I-15, and somewhere as I was getting towards the I-80 exit to head east, a strong mental impression, I don't know how to describe it, came to me and said, oh, you might as well turn around and go home because they're going to all be at reunion today and won't have services. It was middle of July. I knew about reunions. These were the family camps that the Community of Christ does during the summers. And I'd never been to one, but I knew about them from my time in Nauvoo and other reasons. I don't consciously recall that I would have known when the one for Utah was, because it wasn't called Utah. It was called the Intermountain District. And even though I was reading the Saints Herald, the RLDS Church magazine, I'm not sure I would have consciously picked up on that. But this strong impression came saying, no, they're not going to be there. You might as well turn around and go back home. And I began to anticipate the next exit that I could do that. And just before I left the freeway, another impression came, said, no, go ahead. It'll be all right today. And I don't make any claims to special spiritual connections or anything, but these impressions came, and I went ahead, and that was a big step to take, to take my Sunday off from my regular church and go to this so-called apostate group. I got up to the church in Holiday, and lo and behold, everybody was at reunion, except that Sunday in July of 81, they had decided for the first time in many years to have services for those who didn't go to reunion.
Oh yeah, that's out of the ordinary.
Yeah, it's out of the ordinary in for the Utah congregations. There were maybe 10 or 11 people is all. And the only thing memorable about that church service was all of the negative things that I could list. But there was a couple of people there who were very warm and friendly, which I had not expected. And one woman came up to me after the service, and they all knew where I was coming from. There was no question in those days. They could see my Mormon smile.
Yeah.
And this one woman said, you know, here's what's happening today. The service today was pretty bad, but come back next week when everybody's going to be here and give us another chance. And so I did. And I went back, and there were just more and more of that warmth and friendliness. Nobody was pushy. Nobody was trying to persuade me. Oh, the one guy that was the obnoxious guy from the state fair booth was there and still being obnoxious, but he was being overpowered by the other people who were very pleasant and genuine. And I thought, well, okay, I'm going to spend a little bit of time exploring this a little further. I just was not in my mind to change churches at all, but I just wanted to just see where I was headed and try and find some answers for myself. And so over the summer, I spent quite a lot of time talking with church folks. The pastor and his wife were extraordinarily friendly, and they were not from Utah. He was a lifelong RLDS person from Missouri, and she joined the church after they got married. So she was not raised in any Latter-day Saint tradition. And just, they were welcoming and open and friendly. And there was another couple at church that were the same way and inviting me to their home and said, well, you know, why don't you come over for dinner and we can answer some of your questions. And no pushiness at all. They just kind of loved me into the fellowship.
How big would you say it was at that time?
Well, on a good Sunday in the early 80s, we probably had 75 people at church. The congregation took a big hit in the mid-80s when Section 156 was canonized and the ordination of women began. There were a lot of people that were upset with that and decided to not come to church anymore. So we lost quite a bit of momentum at that time.
Yeah, and then later on with the name change, I've heard that Utah also didn't...
the name change was tough for many.
You weren't in Utah.
No, I was. I was. In fact, when the name change took place, I was in South Korea.
Okay.
And so I wasn't in the U.S. at all. Well, sometime during the summer, I guess it was still summer. The pastor, you know, I was going through a divorce. I was worried about my job. My employer got wind of the fact that I'd been attending the RLDS church and told me that if I were to join that church, it might be very difficult for me to continue working for him.
Yeah, that doesn't help.
That's, you know, I mean, a lot of obstacles there. And the family issue, too. You know, that was not an easy thing for my folks to deal with.
How soon did they pick up on you struggling with your LDS experience?
It was that same summer. They knew I was struggling with it, and so that was a lot. Anyway, there was a lot of obstacles. Well, one of the things that the Salt Lake congregation was doing in those days, they were having what we called house church meetings on Wednesday nights. And members of the congregation who could would gather at one of the members' homes on a Wednesday night for, we'd have a light dinner and some, it'd be like a prayer meeting and discussion time and, just, you know, so we were at one of these meetings and it was time to leave and I was out in the car getting ready to go and the pastor, branch president in those days, we called them, came to me and he said, well, he said, I think you need to be baptized. And I said, whoa, wait, what do you mean? He said, well, just offering that. And I said, I need to get my house in order. You know, my life was a disaster. And he said to me, and I'll never forget it, he said, until you commit yourself to Christ, you can never get your house in order. And so with a lot of thought and prayer, I was baptized the end of September of 1981. And in those days, of course, in the, what's now the Community of Christ, we didn't have an option.
Right. You had to be baptized.
Had to be rebaptized. And that was a big struggle for me, too, because my father had baptized me when I was 8, and I didn't want to lose that connection. That was important to me, still is.
Yeah.
But he was right. The branch president was right. I needed to make a commitment to a direction in life. And so, I'm an experienced person with baptisms. You know, I've been baptized in the Salt Lake Temple for 75 proxies.
Right.
So, you know, I've been dunked a few times and also did some dunking.
Right.
As a missionary, I baptized a lot of people. So I was experienced with this, and it was kind of interesting to be on the receiving end again. But I'll tell you, I came up out of that water, and the burden of everything was just lifted from me. My problems weren't solved, but the burden was lifted, and continued to just be involved in church and be engaged. And in time, a priesthood call came, and eventually I began working full time for the church, and spent 9 years in Los Angeles as a church planter and a congregational consultant to work with struggling congregations to try and turn them around.
So you were in California during the 80s?
From 87 to 96.
Okay.
I was in Los Angeles area. And then the church called me to go on a mission to Korea. And so the summer that I dropped my teenage son off at Graceland University to start his college career, I closed up our house and made him homeless by moving to Korea, and spent another 8 or so years there, and was pastor of the congregation in Seoul, and trying to revitalize the ministry, the work of the church there. In the process, began actively involved with the congregation in Taipei, Taiwan, and also began working with some folks in mainland China. After my Korean assignment finished, I was assigned to be leadership development officer for the whole of Asia, and I had to move to Independence, Missouri. I went kicking and screaming, but my assignment was still Asia, so I was commuting from Kansas City Airport to India and Sri Lanka and Philippines and Taiwan and Japan and all places in between.
Right. So I do want to go back. I know I'm going to get some complaints if I don't bring it up, and I just want to hear your perspective on it. What was it like? We've already kind of talked to this off microphone, but what was it like joining One True Church to One True Church? And then also, did other things ever factor into your transition, or is this kind of later on of questions of like whether Joseph Smith had the one true priesthood or Book of Mormon historicity and all the other things that are typically issues for somebody's faith when they're going through a faith crisis and or faith transition?
Well, frankly, I'd already dealt with those issues before I joined the RLDS Church. I'd done enough study of church history and been exposed to different viewpoints that I already wasn't worried about the Book of Mormon, and I wasn't worried about anything one true. And I think I had a pretty secular view even of Joseph Smith, and I knew about the various versions of the first vision, and I had quickly come to the conclusion that the first vision was not the founding moment of the movement. That was a personal conversion experience for Joseph Smith.
Right.
Now, it later became the founding moment, but it was years later. And in fact, after Joseph Smith's death, I mean, even though before he died, the first vision account that became normative in the Pearl of Great Price was published, but it was never used by the missionaries. It was always the Book of Mormon. So the Book of Mormon really was the founding event for the movement.
Yeah, the Angel Moroni in the Book of Mormon.
So, but, you know, I had already moved beyond in my own thinking about one true anything. Yeah, if there is one true church, it's the Church of Jesus Christ in
broad sense,
in the broadest sense.
Yeah.
But in more recent years, I've become even broader than that, saying, well, maybe there isn't even one true path to God. Maybe there are lots of true paths to God, depending on your cultural upbringing and geographical area. But, well, you know, here's an example. When I was working with folks in mainland China who, for the most part, grew up in an atheist society, the question was, amongst all the religions that are out there, Buddhism, Taoism in China, Christianity is another option. And so the question that many Chinese folks would ask me is, why are you a Christian instead of something else? And the only answer that I have for that is, well, because that's how I was raised. That was the cultural context that I was raised in. And my ancestors have probably been Christians for 1,000 years or more. So, you know, what answer could I give otherwise? And quite honestly, I get a little miffed with well-meaning Christian or Mormon missionaries who go to other cultures and say, well, you know, your religion's false. You've got to become not just Christian, but Mormon too. And, you know, that's fine if that's what I believe, but I'm not sure that what's normative for me is what I should impose or try and persuade you to believe in. I don't think religion is a sales pitch. I think it's a personal faith journey. You go back to Fowler's book on the stages of faith. That works for anything that you can call faith, not just Christianity.
Yeah, it's just an approach to
An approach to living your life. And, you know, I've spent enough years in, you know, I've been engaged with South Korea since I was 19. So it's 42 years this year. I know lots of Buddhist monks, and I've been to lots of Buddhist temples, had lots of conversations about faith and life and spirituality. And, you know, and I've been exposed in India to Hinduism. There's some really interesting factors in Hinduism. But, you know, who am I to say, just because I believe something, it's the only right way, and your way's wrong, and if you don't believe in Jesus, you're going to burn in hell. I can't bring myself to be that single-focused.
What you're saying brings up this quote from Reza Aslan. He's written some books about Christianity, but his upbringing is Islam, and he relates that about his Islam. He doesn't consider Islam to be the one true faith, but it's more of a language. It's an expression.
Yeah.
It's the milieu through which he finds and encounters God. And I kind of consider Christianity personally the same way. It's just the language. Religion is like a language just as much as speaking English,
right,
for expressing and thinking about God.
Coming back to that question of Joseph Smith and the priesthood and the Book of Mormon, that's a big deal because the LDS tradition focuses so strongly on those key points as being fundamental to the whole concept of the church, that if there's any other viewpoint that comes to shake those foundations, somehow it would damage or even destroy the whole institution of the church. And would the dynamics of the institution change? Undoubtedly. But does the church as an institution really rise and fall on the shoulders of one man? Or was there really a loss of priesthood, even this so-called great apostasy concept? And does the content of the Book of Mormon have no value unless it is a historical document? And I think the answer to all of those questions is absolutely not. You know, the Lutheran Church doesn't rise and fall on the shoulders of Martin Luther.
Exactly. They're just 300 years more out.
They're just 300 years older than the Latter-day Saint tradition. You know, there, of course, are no special claims about Martin Luther being a prophet and having had a visit from God and all of that. But what Martin Luther was doing, you know, was challenging the very foundations of the Catholic Church. And, and Martin Luther didn't set out to start a new church. He just wanted to reform some practices in the church that he felt were wrong. But the Catholic Church survived that very well, and the Lutheran Church emerged and, you know, has survived all of those historical things. I think Latter-day Saintism can do the same. And it's not to discount the possibilities of angelic or heavenly or divine intervention in things. You know, the Book of Mormon has teachings that have, you know, some good moral value.
Some ones that are not so good.
There's some stuff in there that's, you know, maybe not, but it's the same in the Bible. Right. I mean, there's some stuff in the Bible that, you know, God in one Old Testament passage killed all these children because they had made fun of the prophet who was bald. Well, that's, you know, it's like, well, okay.
Right. So Brittany's in seminary, and so she's taking an Old Testament class right now. And one of her assignments was, how can you relate and make use of the story of Joshua in your ministry today? And she's like,
Okay.
Really struggled with that. And
yeah.
She'll have to tell everybody how she reconciled that, but there's not much you can use Joshua for.
Yeah, there's some, text, yeah, you know? Yeah, there's some stuff there that, you know, it's like, okay. Well, was Joseph Smith a bad person? I don't think so. I think he was a product of his culture, product of the times. There's some things he did that I think are questionable. But, you know, just because somebody does something that's a little questionable or maybe a little unethical in our view, doesn't make them necessarily a bad person. He was a seeker too. I mean, there's no question. He was trying to find his way through things. He had a family that had mixed feelings about religion. Both his father and grandfather had had experiences that are almost word for word identical to the first vision story. So, you know, spirituality was important to the family. And, so that passage in James that Joseph Smith reads,
right,
becomes, it's like, well, sure. Yeah. If any of you lack wisdom, ask God, you know, pray about it. And that fits very well with a Christian context. It fits well, even though his dad was a Unitarian Universalist and his mom was a Presbyterian, which are two rather very different perspectives in the Christian spectrum, that was the kind of foundational principles that he was raised with, that, you know, God was a part of life. And Joseph Smith wasn't the only one who went out and prayed about, you know, the direction he should go in life. He's a teenager. He's hearing all these different viewpoints from the different Christian perspectives. His question was not uncommon. His searching was not uncommon. So, you know, his claims were probably unique. There weren't a lot of people claiming what he claimed. But even the claims of finding this special buried treasure were common to his family.
Right. So everything comes from his milieu, but you bring up, like, does it rise and fall on him? And you can't really say that, because the general impulse through which he worked with all these people, he didn't invent that. He was just responding to a bigger impulse within the society.
Yeah. Well, it was not a unique impulse. It was not a single, what do they call it in space times? A singularity.
Yeah.
And from my perspective of studying the early history, had Joseph Smith not teamed up with Sidney Rigdon, I'm not sure that anything
would
have come beyond this local little group of people. When Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon hooked up in the late, midwinter of 1830-31, there were maybe 120 people in New York. Rigdon had a network of more than 1,000 people in the various congregations that he was the leader of. Rigdon was already sort of like president of a denomination.
Of a different restoration.
He'd separated from the Campbells already.
At that point, okay.
He and Alexander Campbell had their falling out in the summer of 1830. And so I don't like to use the "ite" term, but there was a separate group of Rigdonites who had all separated themselves from Campbell, and a network of several congregations that Rigdon was seen as their spiritual leader. And Parley P. Pratt and Orson Pratt and Edward Partridge were all part of that group, key figures who later emerged in the history of the church. So when I consider it to be a merger of two groups, not that Rigdon somehow converted to Joseph Smith.
A lot of the ideas that came out of the Restoration came straight from Rigdon, though. So the idea of, like, two priesthoods, Melchizedek.
Yeah, all that stuff all was Rigdon. It's all Rigdon. The lectures on faith were written by Rigdon.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, he and Joseph were consulting on things, but that's Rigdon. And, okay, fine. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, so when we get this whole idea of priesthood, you mingle Old Testament and New Testament together – And what we've all come up with is sort of an interesting conglomeration of priesthood that many in the Latter-day Saint movement who are not of the RLDS or the LDS communities, there's still several other communities of Latter-day Saint movement, they've pretty much rejected that idea, and they have the Book of Mormon model of priesthood office. So, for example, the Church of Christ on the Temple Lot, they are led by a quorum of 12 apostles, and they don't have the office of high priest. You've got deacons, priests, and what are the Book of Mormon priesthood offices? Priest and elder, and
I can't remember all of them.
Is it deacon teacher or is it just teacher? I'm not even sure deacon's part of the book. I'd have to.
Yeah, somebody will.
I can't remember. I'll have to look that up. But so a lot of the Latter-day Saint movement is in that model. Now, when I say a lot, number-wise, you know, the LDS Church is the biggest and the Community of Christ is the second largest, and there's a huge gap in between.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, and then everything else.
And then everything else is smaller. But there are those different strains of thought. David Whitmer, early on, was opposed to what Rigdon was doing, and that's what caused the falling out between David Whitmer and his family and Joseph Smith and his family. And Oliver Cowdery kind of got caught in the middle because his wife was a Whitmer, and yet he was Joseph Smith's second in command for a short period of time until Rigdon sort of ousted him by default. But, you know, Whitmer was saying, no, there is no such thing as two priesthoods. There's no such thing as high priest in the New Testament. That's an Old Testament thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's pretty strongly, you know, Campbellite, you know, Alexander Campbell and the Churches of Christ, Disciples of Christ viewpoint on that early thing. And Rigdon just completely had his own ideas after the separation between him and Campbell.
If I recall right, going back to the Book of Mormon, I want to say teacher and exhorter.
Yeah.
A few of them. Yeah. And that kind of models the Methodist tradition
right.
of the time.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And Methodism. I mean, that was, Emma Smith was a Methodist. Joseph Smith spent some time as a member of a Methodist congregation, but was kicked out for his weird views, all before the
right, in 1827,
church was organized. But even the date of the organization of the church, you know, was there not already a church before April 6, 1830? They'd been baptizing people for a year. Oliver and Joseph had been. But that's just, you know, nothing happens in a vacuum. And that's one of the problems of interpretation of church history is that historically, both denominations, LDS and Community of Christ, have seen that as all emerging in a vacuum sort of a way where there were no external influences on anybody, that it was all directly from God to Joseph.
Yeah, like as if there were no church primitivists looking for the original Church of Christ.
Right, yeah, yeah. Nobody else was raising any of those same questions. You know, that was...
When in fact,
everybody was raising... It was commonplace. It was common conversation. They didn't have, you know, farmers in 1830, they did their work on the farm, and then Sunday they did church, and there weren't baseball games and football games and, you know, other external activities to get involved in. And, life revolved around their faith and the questions of faith. And, that was really important to them. And that's what, you know, that's the context out of which the stuff came. And there have been lots of good studies written about that.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.